Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You're listening to the ESPN Footy Podcast.
G'day guys, welcome to Red Time. Jared Barker and Jake Michaels is here. We're back to talk through all the hot topics in the world of AFL ahead of a huge weekend of footy, it must be said. It starts tonight with the showdown. Jake, question without notice, is this the best round of footy that we've had or we're going to have for the season?
Easily, I think so. You look at the fixture and you look at the actual games that we have.
The AFL's done a ripping job. With this week.
Yeah, some of the fixturing can be has left a little to be desired, and a few fixturing quirks that we've spoken about already on the pod, on both. But this round of footy is going to be a cracker.
Yeah.
And as you said, starting tonight, can't wait to watch the showdown.
Yeah. Let's crack in. We're going to start with a fun one. Now, when you think of the face of the NBA, you think of
LeBron James.
I think that's right. And then we had Tom Brady is the face of the NFL for a while, mm-hmm. and you could say it's probably Patty Mahomes these days. And it got us thinking, who is the face of the AFL currently and who's going to be for the next decade?
Well, it's tricky because I think with the NBA and NFL examples you just gave, I don't think anybody would debate it. I don't think there's another name you can sort of throw out that you say it's actually not him, and anyone's, you know, I think it's pretty clear cut who it is. In the AFL, it's not really like that. We don't have anyone that stands out head and shoulders above everyone else and is clear-cut to be the face of the league.
You would have thought maybe Buddy for a long while was,
Buddy,
potentially Dusty.
I think Buddy and Dusty, but so there's a few little, a criteria sheet that you need to go through. You've got to want it. You've got to want to be the face of the league. So going back to the NBA, Nikola Jokic, he might be the best player in the league, but he's not someone who wants it. He doesn't want to be the face of the league. He's not bothered by that. I think Dusty and Buddy both sort of fit in that camp too, whereas they were great players, but I don't think they ever wanted it, and they never sort of sought that recognition and compared to some other players. So I guess it got me thinking, who would it actually be right now? And I think there are a few names that we might be able to discuss, but I think it's still probably Patrick Dangerfield. I think he feels the most known player. And it's got to, you got to go beyond Victoria. I think you got to look at it outside of Victoria, around the country. Super successful. He's won just about everything. Captain of a big club. President of the AFL Players Association.
Yep.
Checks a lot of boxes when it comes to the overall puzzle that is that would contribute to being the face of the league. And I think it's Danger. Now, obviously, we know he's towards the end of his career now, and I don't think it matters that he's as a player, he might not be the player he was, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Yep. I don't think that matters as much. But I think it is Patrick Dangerfield right now. But I don't think it will be for much longer, because someone else is coming. And I think if you go back 2 months to the start of this year, people would have thought this guy was closer to it. Now, he hasn't been poor, but I think people have pumped the brakes on a little, but of course it's Nick Daicos I'm talking about.
Yep.
I think a lot of people would have felt he was right there, ready to take it. Obviously, close to winning a Brownlow medal last year, did play a pivotal role in winning a premiership for Collingwood, plays for the biggest club. There's so many things working in his favour, the young, the name, the aura, everything. He will have it at some stage.
Not, he doesn't have it yet?
I don't think he has it yet.
Is he more recognisable than Patrick Dangerfield? If you ask someone who doesn't live in Victoria, isn't the most avid AFL fan?
It's a good question. The name might be known, but do they know him? Do they know the face outside? And of course, it's very easy to us to look at it and say, well, of course they know who they are. But I think you'd be surprised what other people think. I'm going with Dangerfield. I think Patrick Dangerfield is the face of the league right now, but I don't think he'll have it for that much longer.
Yeah.
I could easily see this time next year, if we ask this same question, we're probably saying it is someone like Nick Daicos.
Yeah, I agree with you. I disagree with Patrick Dangerfield. He's probably in the conversation, but it's interesting how you said it's not as clear in the AFL like it is in the NBA and in the NFL. I would have said it's still Marcus Bontempelli. I know he's not at the biggest club, but I would have thought he's the face of the AFL. And someone like a Charlie Curnow probably has claims, especially if he wins a third Coleman medal at the end of the season.
Can you be the best? Can you be the face
at
of
a really
the league?
Big club?
Well, two things. Can you be the face of a league if you don't play for a big club, with all due respect to the Bulldogs, that they're not a Collingwood?
I think it depends on what you accomplish in your career. I think accomplishments do
have
a lot to do with it.
But he's also never won the highest individual award.
Yep, I understand
which
that.
Which I think you can't be someone that has. You don't play for a huge club and you've never won the biggest award there is to win on an individual level.
It goes beyond that though. As much as winning is a big part of it, it's who you are, it's your status, and it's just about popularity as much as it is about your accomplishments. But that's where I think you're right about Nick Daicos. And you said it, it's the big name, it's the big club. I think most people knew who he was before he even played a game of footy, which does come into it as well. He's won a premiership in his early years. As well, he's going to be in contention for the Brownlow Medal probably for the rest of his career as well. So I think Nick Daicos is the right call. He's going to be the face of the league for the next decade.
I think Charlie Curnow's an interesting one. You mentioned his name could be well on his way to a third Coleman Medal, which doesn't happen in the modern era. Someone kicks the goals like it's the flashy part. It's the highlight of the game, and it's what we see the most.
Yeah.
I think he could be in the frame for it as well. And the other player, which I didn't even write down, just as we started discussing this, it came to me, was Toby Green. Why do we not consider him to be? So he's obviously so well known in both markets.
Yeah.
Now,
to AFL fans more so though, I think Toby.
Of course, but then it comes back to my point before about can you be if you play for a small club? Now I guess he has the benefit of, as I said, he's known in New South Wales because he plays for the Giants, and obviously everyone knows him here. So
yeah,
it's interesting, but same sort of thing. Hasn't won the biggest awards you can win. So it makes it tough to be. And I think you've got to check all of those boxes, and that's what makes it so difficult. We're going to go back to the tribunal, something we were talking about on Tuesday. We spoke about the Jack Higgins 3-game suspension that was handed down by the MRO, but we didn't know what the outcome was going to be. It was taken to the tribunal that night. We now know that it has been upheld and he's going to miss those 3 games. Now, did the tribunal get that right?
So we're not going to spend too long on this because it has already been spoken about a lot, and we spoke about it on Tuesday. Let's go back to the way it was assessed. It was accurate by the MRO, Michael Christian, with the table of offences that he has to work in accordance with. He graded it correctly. So careless, high contact and severe impact. It could only be that way because there was a concussion. So the Saints can't argue the impact down. There was a concussion. But what they did argue was the tackle, or that it wasn't unreasonable and that Alir actually contributed to the outcome because of trying to dispose of the footy and the way that he landed. Now, two things can be true at the same time. The driving motion deserves a suspension, and Alir did contribute it because he tried to dispose of the footy. That doesn't make it his fault, but it is still true all at the same time. Now, is that tackle worth 3 weeks? No. Did the AFL tribunal get it right? Yes. And that's the AFL's fault because how are they supposed to argue that down? The inconsistency here is appalling, and I think Andrew Dillon and Laura Kane have their work cut out to try and correct all of this at the end of the season. I think every incident needs to be assessed in isolation as well. We're looking at the tribunal guidelines and the table of offences for every single incident. So I think you need to have a different guidelines for bumps. It needs to be different for dangerous tackles, which needs to be under a different set of guidelines for striking offences as well. And until we start looking at incidents in isolation and judging them differently, we're always going to have this inconsistency in these arguments, and we're always going to see a tackle like this be 3 weeks and a bump like Cozzy Pickett's last year only be 2 weeks.
Yeah, and I think you nailed it. I think so many people are coming out and crushing the MRO, Michael Christian, and crushing the tribunal for the way in which this is played out. And not just this one. We've seen, half a dozen similar-ish incidents in the way they've played out already this year, and we're going to see dozens more. It's the reality of the situation. It's the guidelines that you need to be frustrated with.
Yeah.
And that's what desperately needs changing, in my opinion, and it seems like you agree with me too, because that's what causes the frustration, that it is so focused on the action as opposed to the outcome. And I think you raised a really interesting point about we do look at, it's the same grading system for any type of incident you can think of. And it shouldn't be that way. Everything should be looked at on its individual merit, but it's very difficult to do that. Now, do I have? I'm not saying I have the perfect answer as to how they do it moving forward, but what I know is, and what's quite clear, is what we're currently doing just isn't working.
Yep, I agree. Hey, we spoke about this one off the top. What's the biggest rivalry in our game today?
They're kind of like the question about the face of the league. There, nothing stands out head and shoulders above the rest. But if I'm picking one, it's the showdown. I think the showdown is a game, and I'm not just saying that because it's on tonight and I'm looking forward to watching it, but it is the game, or the two games of the year, I look forward to watching the most outside of finals and outside of games my team is playing in. It's the game I really look forward to watching, and that's because of the drama. It's always a spectacle. It's such a big deal for the state of South Australia, the showdown. And I don't think people realise how big it is until you actually go to one.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary game to be at.
Genuine hatred between the clubs as well, it feels like.
Yeah.
When you hear the players talk about it.
And it's not fabricated. It's 100% genuine how they feel. Yeah. The other part of it which makes it great is we've seen so many great finishes in showdowns. It's not been blowouts and, you know, oh yeah, they hate each other, but the games are never close. We've seen some of the most epic finishes in the showdown. You only have to go back to Jordan Dawson's goal after the siren. We've seen so many epic finishes in that game. And I think that one would be the one. A lot of people will look at other older rivalries, Collingwood Essendon, Carlton Collingwood, Essendon Hawthorn, whatever you want to look at. They might be historically, and I think rivalries come and go. I don't think something that was a rivalry remains a rivalry forever. You know, West Coast and Sydney was a great rivalry in the mid-noughties, and we saw Hawthorn and Geelong as a rivalry. But if Hawthorn, Geelong, now I know they play Easter Monday, do you still see Hawthorn and Geelong as a great rivalry?
It's a rivalry, yes, but it's because of the historical context behind those two clubs. And you're right, it is the same.
But when the sets of players are almost completely different.
Well, that's right, but it's a fan-based thing, right? So Carlton and Collingwood used to be the biggest rivalry because of what's happened in the 70s and the 80s. And the reason why they hate each other today or the fans dislike the other club is because your dad probably told you when you were growing up, you have to hate this club. It's like, oh, all right, I'll do that then. There's no other reason. I mean, I would argue that the Pies and the Bombers have a better rivalry than the Blues and the Pies today because of Anzac Day. That's actually become. That's not to say that Carlton and Collingwood can re-establish itself as the best rivalry. I think it can now that the Pies have won a premiership, the Blues are on their way up, and I think they should be contending now for quite some time. Once they meet in the final, they're going to be the biggest rivalry again. But the only genuine match that those two clubs have played in like the last 30 years with real substance and ramifications and finals implications was the round 23 2022 match where Collingwood had to win to make the top four, and that kicked Carlton out of the finals. That's the only game of genuine substance they've probably played in at least three decades.
I agree, and that has to contribute for something. What about Sydney and GWS?
I don't think that's ever going to become bigger than any of the ones we've spoken about.
Could that ever be...
It's not big. The game, and I think this does come into it, the game isn't that big up there for it to be such a spectacle.
If they played each other in the grand final this year, and then we go into next year, they're the two best sides, and they've already played numerous times in finals.
Yep.
That's been the most common matchup we've seen because they've played three finals already, and they have. Yeah. So.
But yet, we don't say it's the biggest rivalry.
We don't even look at it as a rivalry at all. I think that has a massive chance of being a legitimate top tier rivalry, but you're saying it can't be because if people don't go and the interest isn't there in New South Wales, can it just not be? It's never going to be what it is in South Australia. It's never going to be what it is in Western Australia. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
I think it's the showdown, but it's going to be Carlton and Collingwood again, I think.
Moving on, we've got a question about Ruckman here, which I know you wanted to put in here, and I'm excited to see what you say.
So, I know you love Ruckman, Jake.
Where does Max Gawn rank among the best rucks of the 21st century?
One. He ranks one. He's first.
You got him
first?
Yeah,
he's the best ruck. And I think so, but there are different types of ruckman, which we need to note here. And I'm not that strong on this, to be honest. We've had to take a look. Well, I think he's number one based on this. We've taken a look at the stats and we've compared him with the best ruckman of the last couple of decades, or the ruckman we think were the better ruckman, just so we can have some sort of way that we can compare him to these other players in his positions. So we looked at disposals, hit-outs to advantage, clearances, contested possessions, marks, contested marks, intercept possessions, and goals too. So 10 categories there, and Gawn comes out on top in 6 of them. Now, that's being compared to guys like Aaron Sanderlands and Dean Cox, who I think a lot of people would see as the best couple of ruckmen in the last 2 decades or so. But again, they're all different ruckman. You think of the modern day Brody Grundys and Tim English, who can get around the ground a bit more mobile, act as that extra midfielder. Aaron Sanderland's probably more dominant with his height in the ruck contest. Dean Cox could do everything. He wasn't really lacking in too many areas as a ruckman. But Jake, the numbers don't lie. Cox is probably the better player in terms of technical ability and skill. He's probably a better footballer.
So why do you say that? You think
Well, literally just looking at him kick a ball and doing things below his knees that maybe I don't think Gawn can. But then when you look at what you want from a ruckman and the overall influence on a game, I still think Gawn, and based on these numbers, does actually come out on top. Cox, a better footballer technically, but Max Gawn, a better ruckman, if that makes sense. Now, yeah, we all know what your views are on ruckman, Jake. I know you dislike them. You reckon they're as pointless as a inflatable dartboard. That's what you usually tell me. So I want to know what you think about this. Is he the best ruckman of the 21st century?
Well, I've seen these numbers and I agree. And I've never said Max Gawn is a bad ruckman, ever. I've just questioned the value of that position for all these players.
That's fair.
So if you're comparing him to everyone else that's played that position, that I am all skeptical about. Of course, I'll concede. I think he is one. If he's not one, he's probably two. And as you say, and I thought that before seeing these numbers, and the numbers only justified. I think that what he does that makes him so valuable is his contested marking and his intercept marks.
That's
particularly
a highlight,
the
yeah.
intercept contested marks, which he is streets ahead of the rest of them in.
Yeah,
and people can talk about, oh, he wins the ball and his hit-outs, but most hit-outs don't go to advantage. People don't want to realise that. Most hit-outs don't go to advantage. But it's the marking, and that's what he does, and that's where the value is with Gawn. I agree with you. I don't think Max Gawn is an ultra-skilled player, but I don't think any of those guys you necessarily mentioned are.
Yeah.
I'm happy for him to be the number one ruck of the last 20 years, but where does he rank in terms of players? I'm not putting him in my top 50.
I didn't think you would.
And I don't think that's crazy. And if people want
to top 100?
Probably not. I think you can make a list of 100 players, or close to it, that are better footballers, the overall package, than Max Gawn. But if you want to say he's the best ruckman, I'll agree with you on that, because I don't look and say, oh, Shane Mumford, gee, he was such an amazing player, what he could do with the ball. If Max Gawn's got a shot 30 metres out directly in front of you, comfortable?
No.
If Max Gawn's got to hit a 10 metre handball, are you comfortable? The basic fundamental skills of the game, I'm still not comfortable with him executing at any given moment.
Yeah, you always find a way to just diss on the ruckman, don't you?
Well,
any opportunity.
It's just the reality of the situation.
I think it's totally fair enough, though.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And well said. Now, this is obviously prompted by their 7-0 start to the season, and they've got another big game against Melbourne this weekend, the Cats. But I think it's a fair question to ask anyway. Is Chris Scott the best coach of the modern era?
I don't know what the answer to this is. I know it sounds like a bit of a cop-out answer, or lack thereof, but I think he's right there. And I've been skeptical of Chris Scott too, and there's been things that have frustrated me with him. But he's got a lot of things working for him. He's making a great case that he is. Now, what do we say is the modern era? We use modern era all the time, but what do we actually say?
Pretty subjective.
Are we saying post-2000? Are we saying last 15 years? Like, I kind of look at it post-2000.
Yep, and I think that's fair.
And you kind of need to coach your whole career since then. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to overlap, and you've had 4 or 5 years in the 2000s, but everything else was pre.
Lee Matthews, etc.
Yeah, so let's look at everything that's been done since 2000.
Yeah.
So he's won two flags, as we know, and he's done that 11 years apart. So that's important as well. It wasn't just, I've done it once, and the following year we come back and we do it again, and you don't hear from me anymore.
It's a level of success that he's been able to maintain, which is different to a lot of these other coaches.
Yeah, and it's two very, very different teams that won it. Now, people can say, and I think it was a fair enough criticism or question mark on Scott, was that he came in and they won it straight away. Was it his team? Was it Bomber Thompson's team? How much credit does he get for walking in and taking them straight to the premiership? I think the fact that he's gone and won another one with a very different team, obviously some pieces still there, but a very different team, and as you say, maintain a level of consistency, a high level of consistency throughout that 10-year stretch in the middle, is, you have to admire that.
Yeah.
The other part of it is his winning percentage, which is off the back of that, 71.35%, which is an extraordinary number given how long he's coached, over 300 games. That's a very high number. It dwarfs anybody else that's in the conversation. Most people would say Alistair Clarkson. He's at 56%. He's miles behind. Even take out the North Melbourne stuff, he's still nowhere near the 60s. So he's a long way ahead. And the other part of it is his worst year, which obviously is off the back of the win percent as well, was last year, 10-1-12. That's his worst year. That is a very good worst year when you've coached for as long as he has.
Still contending for the finals. And the only other year that didn't make the finals was 2015, and it was very similar.
Yeah.
Still in contention a couple of weeks out.
So I know people can say, oh, well, Clarko's won 4 flags. And if we were just going off flags, then we don't need to ever even have these debates at all for anything. But I don't think it is. I think it's far more than just who's won the most premierships, because it's not like that for anything else. And I think with Clarko, there's also the same sort of, well, how much weight do you give him? Because that team was so good. It felt like a foregone conclusion when they were winning the 3 in a row. We knew, we were so confident in those teams going into those seasons when they were winning. Now, he obviously does deserve credit, but I want to see him do what he can do with North Melbourne before I start to say, I'm not saying he needs to go and win a premiership next year, but I want to see him turn that club around with the personnel that's there before I can start labeling him as the greatest coach to ever do it, like some people have already done and have been prepared to do for a number of years. So I'm holding fire on Clarko. Yep, he deserves to be in the discussion with Chris Scott.
Yeah.
But I think they're pretty close. I think they're pretty close right now. What I will say is there's someone else, a current coach, who is maybe not quite on that level, but a rung below. And I don't think anyone ever considers this coach. John Longmire. Why do we not put him in the same category as these guys?
Very similar to Geelong, the Swans, when I say maintaining that level of success and consistent finals appearances as well, you are right.
Chris Scott has coached 316 games and John Longmire's coached 314 games. It's almost identical.
Yeah.
So Scott has 2 flags, Longmire has 1, but Longmire's been to 4 grand finals, Scott's been to 3. Scott's got 13 finals wins and Longmire has 12. he has so much to... I know we're forecasting a bit now. It's all hypothetical stuff. But if the Swans go and win it this year, which is not a crazy take given how they've started the year, he has the most to gain in terms of his legacy. Because if we're saying that Chris Scott might be the best coach of the modern era, and I don't think that's an outrageous take, Longmire would only go ahead of him if he wins it this year, because he will have won more flags. He would have won the same amount of flags. He would have been to more grand finals, and he would have won more finals games. And we talk about that consistency over a long period of time. So I think everyone's sleeping a little bit on John Longmire. And of course, he needs to go and do it. It's a big if, you know, will they go and win it this year? You could say, well, what if the Cats go and do it? If the Cats go and do it, I think Chris Scott is cemented as the number one. The other one is Damien Hardwick. People will mention him. People say he should be in the conversation. I think he should as well. Similar to Clarko, kind of want to see what he can do at another club.
That's
before
fair.
The
Hawks and the Tigers with Dimmer was sort of bad, good, and now bad, if you can look at it like that. Whereas the Swans and the Cats with that consistency, I think that does...
That has to count for a lot.
And staying up there in a time where the competition is more even than it ever has been, and the gap between the best and the worst isn't as big as it once used to be, I think that matters for something as well. So I like your take there. I think, Chris Scott with 11 finals series and 8 prelims as well. That's huge.
You'd be pretty comfortable saying...
There's a clear case that Chris Scott is the best coach since, we'll say, the 21st century.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Speaking of Alistair Clarkson, he's got a decision to make about Harry Sheezel, and he's been playing him, obviously, out of defence. He's playing well. Is it time he made the move and pushed Sheezel into the midfield?
I'll give my opinion, but I'll also give you these numbers from Champion Data. Now, of Harry Sheezel's 3,000-ish minutes played in the AFL, he's only spent 190 minutes in the midfield or on the wing. It's not a lot. And only 25 minutes this season. 25 minutes in 7 rounds he's played in the midfield. I think I worked it out to be about nearly 50 seconds a quarter in the midfield, which is absolutely nothing in a 20-minute quarter. So it's not even like there's a big enough sample size to know if using him in the middle is going to be more beneficial than keeping him off a back flank. But we can look at what he has done. And last season, he was minus 2.6 rating points based on the 100X system. So your expected rating playing in that position. It means he performed below expectation last season.
It's such a
as a midfielder.
Sample size, though.
But this season, he's plus 18.8, which is extraordinarily high. But again, you're right. It's so only 25 minutes worth of data. So how much do you take out of that? This is where it gets interesting. As a forward last season, he was plus 3.5. He spent 258 minutes forward. And as a defender, which we know is where he spent most of his time, he was plus 1.1. So you can almost mount the argument that he was more valuable ahead of the ball than he was behind the ball last year. Anyway, so look, I get why Clarko and the Kangas have tried to ease him into the competition.
Why?
In a position. Well, just to, I guess.
Because I'm always a bit skeptical about this reasoning.
The Pies did the same thing with Nick Dacos, keeping him away from, letting him play early so we can sort of increase his development, but keep him out of the contest, let him do his thing. He's a good ball user as well, so it makes sense. You can only do that with a certain type of player, and I think Sheezel is one of them. But he's third for disposals this year, second for effective kicks, and first for effective disposals, but he's 71st for average rating points per game. So I think it's time.
Wow.
You know, they're getting smashed anyway. I understand you're losing something when you take him out of the back line, but what do you have to lose to throw him into the midfield when you know as he matures, he's going to develop into a goal-scoring midfielder anyway?
Well, that's the
I don't think there's anything to lose, and I don't think there's anything wrong with him playing in defence. I'm not really as strong on this as some other people seem to be, but I don't see the bad side in playing him in the midfield.
Yeah,
especially when he's only spent 25 minutes in there this season.
Agree. I just think, why wait? Why wait when you know it's going to happen?
Like, let him show us what he can do.
Yeah, and I get it with Nick Dacos, the not wanting to play him in the midfield. I think it was a very different situation, though. I think I'm not saying Sheezel's Harley Reid or massive body coming straight in where it's not a concern, but he is bigger than Dacos. And the Pies had the luxury of, they had a lot of players through that midfield that was like, they didn't necessarily need him to go straight in there. The one benefit, if you will, of being a really poor side is you don't have that many players and you can put him straight in there. You don't have anything, you're not going to lose out on anything by putting him in the midfield. If you know he's going to end up playing there, why delay it? And that's what I find a little strange. And I can get it from maybe the first year. When is it going to happen? If not, why are we not seeing it now? Because I think he's played enough games. I think the questions are starting to come over not his ball use, but the value. Is he providing the most value in that position? For North and what they want to do moving forward? And I'd say no. I think I'd get him in the midfield, get him in there like we've seen with Harley Reid, and you just get them to develop sooner rather than later.
Last question. Is it season over if Brisbane loses to the Gold Coast Suns this week?
Oh, is that a rivalry? Where does that rank on the rivalry?
It's a rivalry, but the Q clash. Not there yet. Not yet. Once the Suns make finals, perhaps.
Maybe. I think it would be. I'm not liking their chances. They'd be 2-6, and it would be, I mean, let's face it, catastrophic, given how close they were to winning a premiership last year. Since 2000, we've seen 40... There have been 40 teams start a year 2-6.
Yep.
Four of those 40, so 4-36, that's the ratio of going on to play in finals. So it's not looking good. And none of those four went past the semis. So they would have their work cut out for them. But I think what people will say is, but they can turn it around. They can turn around. Even I've said that in the past, going back to sort of 2-3 weeks into the season, they can turn it around. The reason that they would be 2-6 is because they're a poor side. They'd be four games outside the 83+ percentage. It's so much to have to make up. And I just don't think they can do it because we look at them as saying, they can do it because they're a good side, but they're not. That's why they're 2-6.
Yeah.
So I don't think so. I think it would be just about season over in terms of winning a premiership.
Yeah.
Now, could they come back and make finals? Maybe, but I just don't see any way that they can turn it around enough to actually challenge for a
I'll agree with you. The only thing that I'll say is Carlton and GWS last year were 15th and 14th after round 15. They had 5 and 6 wins. Now, this is Brisbane's stretch coming up. After the Q clash, they have Adelaide, Richmond, Hawthorn, the Dogs and St Kilda. I don't think they're winning all of them, but they are all winnable. And I think 3 of their next 5 will get them to, I think, within striking distance. If they win 4, they'll be level pegging again. I don't think they'll play finals, you are right. But so I don't think it's doom and gloom.
How would you feel if they're 6-6 or 7-7? You wouldn't be concerned. You'd still think they're a finals chance.
Yeah.
A chance of making finals or a chance of winning finals?
It depends on how they've played. But as long as you have that record, you've won enough games to be, as I said, within striking distance of 8th spot, and it depends on the points of 8th spot as well. Well, then they can still make finals, for sure. But it depends on what they do in this stretch. We'll leave it there, Jake. Thank you for today's episode. And to everyone at home, thank you for listening. And don't forget your tips as well. How are you doing with your
I started really well. I was giving Matt a bit of stick because I think he got 0 in... It wasn't. I don't think it was opening. It was round one. It was
when round they were one, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. So,
been a tough.
But
year,
it's
though.
Been a bit of a downward trend since then for me, unfortunately. But you're going pretty well.
I'm one ahead of you.
Oh, yeah, going that well.
Bragging rights still though. thank you. Enjoy the footy this week, guys. As I said, don't forget your tips, and we'll speak to you on next week's episode.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.